Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. And I'll tell you so.
Everyone, I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome you to a special presentation. What is not being discussed or investigated concerning the COVID pandemic? Many of the official statements by Anthony Fauci and others at the CDC, the World Health Organization, the FDA, the White House, are simply wrong. But how wrong? Is it by accident? Is it unintended or intended? My guest today, Professor David Martin, is going to examine this in great detail. I believe that he will be sharing insights and documentation that you have not heard before. Even as scientists and physicians working in the war on the COVID virus, this is brand new information, and it will completely change our perception of what we've been dealing with. Dr. Martin is a scholar. He is a researcher and professor, and he has been at one of the Darden Graduate School of Business Administration, University of Virginia, and he is extremely aware of what's occurring. With that said, I believe that what he is about to share with us will be as significant, if not more, than what was shared with us many years ago in the Pentagon Papers, which was the history of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam between 1945 and 1967. The Pentagon Papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War with the bombings of nearby Cambodia and Laos, coastal raids in North Vietnam, and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were being reported in the mainstream media. The study consisted of 3,000 pages of historical analysis and 4,000 pages of original government documents in 47 volumes. They were classified top secret and sensitive. There was a total of 15 published copies, and the think tank, the RAND Corporation, received two of those copies. Daniel Ellsberg knew the leaders of the task force well. He had worked as an aide to John McNaughton, McNamara's Assistant Secretary of Defense, from 1964 to 1965. And worked on the study for several months, 1967, later opposing the war. Ellsberg and his friend Anthony Russo photographed the study in October 1969, intending to disclose it. In February 1971, Ellsberg discussed the study with the New York Times reporter Neil Sheehan and gave 43 of the volumes to him. The New York Times began publishing excerpts on June 13, 1971. The first article in the series was titled Vietnam Archive. Pentagon study traces three decades of growing U.S. involvement. The study was dubbed the Pentagon Papers. I'm curious to see what our guest reporting and extreme scholarship will reveal about COVID, what we have not been told, what they have known all along, and why there are so many contradictions between the actual science and the reported controlled narrative science. That is what is important. For example, the idea that the PCR is a gold standard. So once you have your analysis that you're positive or negative, then you're a case, you're infected. That has been shown not to be true, that the lockdown is the way to go. That has been shown not to be true. And also that all of the deaths that have occurred that justify the lockdown are needed and are scientifically based. None of that is true. Now let's go to our guest and ask him to lay this out. And I'm going to ask very few questions during this hour, as I want him to unpack this in a way that we can all understand. Please understand that everything that he will be telling you, unless he says something different than some pre-interviews, we have asked to verify and validate the documents, which we have done. Therefore, I am confident in the accuracy and veracity of what will be his statements. Now to our guest. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Martin.
Well, Gary, first of all, lovely to meet you and lovely to share some time with your listeners. You've asked a series of interrelated questions. And so I think it's important to establish first and foremost for everyone what a patent actually is. I think most people use those terms, you know, innovation, invention, patent, without really understanding the core, both statutory and practical implementations of what that is. And if we go back, and to do this, we need to go back several hundred years, patents were a crown law, somewhat anachronism, which was the notion that you could put boundaries in concepts, just like you have boundaries on property. And within those boundaries, a person who owned the rights to use the thing in those boundaries could limit anyone else from using or accessing those boundaries. So if we think about it from the standpoint of property, and by the way, the reason why the word claim is used is for exactly that reason. A claim is the stake that is the definition of what the boundaries of a thing are. So patents were granted as a no trespassing zone in the mind. They tell you what you cannot do without permission, what you cannot use without permission. And if we go back to the founding of the United States, we realize that Thomas Jefferson, the country's first patent examiner, found patents to be an odious offense to free markets. He thought that they were unnecessary. He felt that they were an assault on the free market ideals that he had. But he actually also saw them as a necessary compromise to help fuel the fledgling new colonies economy. So there was a trade-off. But if we actually understand what a patent is, the best way to think about it is a no trespassing sign on an idea. That's something that says that you cannot go a place. Now, it is important because this issue has been repeatedly, allegedly fact-checked by individuals who have no idea what I just said, but the establishment fact-checkers have failed to understand the core of patent law, which is what I just described, that this is a no trespassing zone on a concept. Under 35 U.S. Code Section 101, patentable subject matter has been defined, and one of the many things that cannot be patented, like perpetual motion machines or mathematic formula, one of the things that cannot be patented is nature. Nature as it exists cannot be patented, which gives rise to the problem that is manifest in the patent. And here's the tiny little technical problem. Fact checkers have been abundantly incapable of reading the actual documents associated with CDC's patent that was filed in April of 2003 after the SARS coronavirus outbreak reportedly in Asia. And patent 7220852 makes a number of statements which are actually quite important. The first is coronavirus have not been previously known to cause severe disease in humans, but have been identified as a major cause of upper respiratory illness, including the common cold. Now, that's reading directly from their patent. Additionally, from their patent, they actually identify the fact that they have identified a sequence identification, what they call sequence ID1, which is a nucleic acid sequence, which is actually part of 405 nucleotides of the coronavirus gene. And they specifically say that that particular 405 nucleotide length piece of the gene is the thing that allegedly is what gives rise to SARS coronavirus. Now, they didn't do anything. So this is the point that I make in the film. They did not do anything to modify this reportedly What they did do is they patented what they say is a coronavirus gene taken from humans. The actual title of the patent itself is coronavirus isolated from humans. Now, when you look at that patent, there's a tiny little problem in that there are three patents that carry essentially a similar name. And so when people at the lazy fact-checking organizations fail to actually look precisely at what they're talking about, they actually will pull up patents that were affiliated with this one that have to do with the measurement of and the treatment of the SARS coronavirus infections. But the fact of the matter is, patent 852 is in fact a patent on nature, which is in fact illegal. It is illegal to patent nature. It's illegal to try to control the rights to nature. And most problematically, and this is where, once again, fact checkers and science have become uncomfortable, absent bedfellows, for the phylogeny of the virus, which is in fact a subclade, is what it's called. It's a subclass of the SARS coronavirus family of beta coronaviruses. For a coronavirus to be a SARS coronavirus, including the one that we're dealing with reportedly right now, for it to be the severe acute respiratory syndrome virus, it must contain all or most of the nucleic acid sequence that makes it a SARS virus. And so when people say, well, this particular patent has nothing to do with the current SARS-CoV-2, that's actually both technically and legally not correct. For it to be SARS, it has to contain the 405 nucleic acid sequence, which is in fact the thing that the CDC patented. Now, the reason why this is a problem, beyond the fact that you can't patent nature, therefore making the patent that the CDC took out illegal, is that the patent office itself rejected as unpatentable subject matter this particular patent. This is little facts that people also don't look at. You know, the CDC has often said they were patenting it so that no one could commercially exploit SARS coronavirus, but the fact is that that's patently false. The patent office rejected their patent application, told them that they couldn't get it, and they actually insisted in 2007 on overturning the patent examiner's determination of not granting the patent and insisted on getting it. Not only did they do that, they also filed a secrecy petition on the application itself. So anybody who is naive enough to think that the actual records at the patent office were somehow a conspiracy theory issued by those of us who are doing investigations is actually delusional. The actual documentation is in fact 100% supporting the allegation that the patent was in fact an illegally granted, illegally sought patent by the CDC. And the fact that they took it out became problematic for the rest of our story, because once a federal agency owns a patent, and in this particular case, they own not only the gene patent, but they also own the patent on the detection and the treatment of SARS coronavirus. What that meant was independent organizations, enterprises, or individuals were not able to independently verify any statements made about SARS, about coronavirus, about anything else. And therein lies the reason why we are sitting in 2021, and the reason why we were met in 2020 with the fact that there was no commercial test to detect SARS coronavirus, and it could not have been made because that patent was owned by the Center for Disease Control. So the very organization that has alleged to be this helpless, overwhelmed organization that in January and February was overwhelmed by a surprise disease sat on a patent for the detection of this thing for 17 years and did nothing. But then let's ask the second question, because the second half of your question is equally important, possibly more important. In 1999, Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Ralph Baric at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, decided to look at coronavirus as a recombinant technology that could have its pathogenicity amplified. Now, let's unpack that a little bit. You heard in the very language of the patent claim from CDC, or the patent disclosure in CDC, you heard me state that they said, you know, coronavirus has just not been associated with severe disease in humans. That's their own statement. But here's an interesting problem. If you look at the NIAID-funded study that Fauci and Baric collaborated on in 1999, they started looking at recombinant mechanisms to manipulate coronavirus to increase the degree to which it could be potentially capable of harming humans. Now, let's talk about the cover story. The cover story is that according to many researchers, when you have potential pathogens out in the world, it's helpful to manipulate them in the laboratory to see if you can amplify certain attributes of those viruses, usually the receptors or some part of the way in which the virus interacts with the cell, such that you can anticipate where mutations, whether they be natural or whether they be laboratory made, where mutations might ultimately occur that could become harmful to people. So the plausible deniable argument is that the reason why they wanted to do this is to see if coronaviruses could somehow one day become super pathogens. And so, and by the way, they've made frequent reference to the fact that all of these research projects that are funded by military funds and military grants are all in the name of peacetime anticipation of epidemics, which if you want to believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you in a swamp. But the fact of the matter is, in 1999, NIAID started funding the amplification and modification of coronavirus to make it more pathogenic, specifically focused on moving what used to be primarily a vascular targeted pathogen into a respiratory targeted pathogen. And what do I mean by that? The S1 spike protein, which you've heard a lot about, and the ACE2 receptor, which you have not heard a lot about, are the two features of the current SARS viral model that allegedly attack the respiratory tract. And with respect to the ACE2 receptor, they also attack parts of the renal system. There are a bunch of ACE2 receptors in the kidneys as well. But the fact of the matter is, those had not been a problem for humans other than issuing, you know, from time to time, little infections like the common cold. But I find it interesting that for the millions or billions or how many ever years you want to think humans have been around and viruses have been around, for the entirety of the natural evolution of coronavirus, we have not had SARS. And then 1999 comes along, we start manipulating the virus. And then 3 years later, we have the first SARS outbreak. I am a practical and logical person. And as a practical and logical but inquisitive person, I find it ironic that 3 years after humans started amplifying the pathogenicity of a virus, the virus suddenly started attacking the respiratory system when their specific target of what they were amplifying was in fact targeting the respiratory system. Now, we can believe in quantum entanglement. We can believe in pure improbabilities, we can believe in alien invasions, we can believe in whatever we want to wrap around this narrative. But I find it disingenuous for any scientist to suggest that nature somehow happens to evolve along the very research lines that humans dictate 2 or 3 years ahead of time. I find it equally improbable that the only place where coronavirus pathogenicity seems to be both amplified in the laboratory happens to also be the only place where we seem to have outbreaks of the accidental natural genetic transfer of exactly the same virus. Why is it, for example, that in 2016, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, Coronavirus 1, was transferred to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, when according to all of the records, as early as 2013, what we now call COVID symptoms were seen in people from whom the Wuhan Institute of Virology 1 virus was isolated. Why is it that that was sent to North Carolina? Why, during the moratorium on gain of function research, did the University of North Carolina authorize research on a Chinese mutation of coronavirus? And why is it that that is the mutation that has 90%+ homology to what is allegedly the novel SARS coronavirus that allegedly came out of nature when allegedly a bat flew over a pangolin and walked into a wet bar in China, right? The problem that we have is that to believe the narrative that we've been told is actually more implausible than actually suggesting that individuals, through intentional or accidental reasons, actually were the reason why we have this virulent pathogen. And the fact is that the evidence is overwhelming that not only do we have it, but we also paid for it. And then worse than that, and this is the part that I find most frustrating with both the mainstream media and with fact checkers, is when they go to investigate the source of this particular pathogen, they let the individuals who have a financial interest in the outcome lead the investigation, which in my view is analogous to letting bank robbers investigate a bank heist. You simply would not do that if you weren't trying to stack the deck to support a narrative rather than to uncover the facts.
I appreciate that in-depth analysis. Could we take it one step further, please? And that is, since this virus has upset and adversely affected most nations on the planet, we would reasonably expect to see an outcry by the mainstream media, by independent journalists and scientists, and ask a basic question: where did this virus originate? And from, and to determine from which place, and also determine once and for all whether it was engineered in a lab, as you're suggesting, or arose naturally from Chinese wet markets, as you suggested, but also as Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates and others have determined, in the mainstream media has orchestrated a virtual campaign that anyone suggesting it was human-made is a conspiracy theorist and therefore is not credible. The silence on this, especially by the United States government and the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Services, and Anthony Fauci's group, is perplexing. And issues also involving Fauci, as the second part of this, the financial conflicts of interest that are known to exist with Anthony Fauci and the CDC, and with Moderna, and also with Gilead, the developer of remdesivir, which has not been shown to be efficacious, but is what made hundreds of millions of dollars in profit for the company, who Anthony Fauci also supports. And one last tagline to this is that if we really cared, if Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates and the President of the United States, the former and the current, were to care about saving lives, why didn't we have a national program to show people who had comorbidities how to better protect themselves? Why did we not encourage people to be healthier with peer-reviewed literature? We found over 27,000 studies in the Library of Medicine on vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, as examples of what could help the body's immune system. Not a word on that. In fact, we were told specifically, don't do anything until the vaccine or to a new miracle drug. In the interim, hundreds of doctors have come forward, and there are now over 217 studies that we have found, 111 of them in the peer-reviewed literature, supporting the efficacy and safety of hydroxychloroquine with zinc and zithromycin, and also 41 studies as of today and counting, all positive on the other drug that ivermectin or mectin that ivermectin that's been shown to at small doses from 8 to 30 milligrams stop the virus within 2 to 3 days, and there's a overall efficacy rate of preventing people from going into the hospital and reversing the virus's outcome by 68%. Even in hospital, if you're sick, it brings it down to 38% survival of people who would otherwise have to go on to ventilation and probably die. Not a word to support that, but everything to condemn it. So I'm seeing things that are known and proven by quality science to work, that are inexpensive, condemned and attacked. The promoters of those people who are just regular board-certified physicians attacked, some of them having their licenses challenged or their teaching positions challenged. At the same time, everyone says, wait for the vaccine, as if that's the only thing that we should have done up to this point. Could you unpack each of those, please?
Well, yeah, once again, I'll do my best to make sure that what we do is stay in a general audience environment rather than getting overly technical on this. But let's start with the fact that in 1984, when Dr. Anthony Fauci took over NIAID, he immediately infected the NIAID-CDC relationship with a vaccine-only model. While he did support research to look at other treatments, particularly around HIV, his obsession, as evidenced from the minutes of his own advisory committee meetings, which are part of the Federal Register and part of NIAID's official archive, make it abundantly clear that in Anthony Fauci's world, vaccine was the ultimate answer to anything, including, by the way, in 2018, his obsession with finding a vaccine for the opioid crisis, if you want to go as crazy as you can possibly get. This coming from a person who knew that there were pharmaceutical formulations for opioids that were non-addictive, but rather than forcing those to become commercially available, he decided to spend money on a vaccine for opioid addiction. And that was in 2018, September of 2018. Dr. Anthony Fauci sees the world through a very singular lens, and that is the vaccine lens. And it's important to understand that the reason to do that is because a misinterpretation of the 1905 Jacobson case in Massachusetts has meant that if you want to force a medical intervention on humans, calling a thing a vaccine is commercially the most advantageous for a whole bunch of reasons. The first is that you get states that have been manipulated or co-opted by the pharmaceutical industry, who are the agents where, while you would not get a federal statute mandating vaccine use, state police powers have been construed to mean that if somebody builds a vaccine, then states can mandate that vaccine's use. And you'll see that time and time again, despite the fact that numerous pieces of evidence exist that there is little to no justification for the use of general population vaccines for the purpose of police powers, as defined back in the Massachusetts case in 1905. The fact of the matter is, if you can get something called a vaccine, you can get states to mandate its use. And by mandating its use, you create a cash cow that not only generates vast enrichments to the pharmaceutical industry, but the other side, which is the real benefit, is it shields manufacturers from any liability. And let's face it, if you can make a product for which the federal law says you will never have a shred of liability, or you could make products for which you actually might have culpability, you are going to default to making things for which your liability shield is absolute. And if you can get something to be called a vaccine, whether it meets the legal definition of a vaccine, whether it meets the legal definition of immunity, or whether it meets the legal definition of the public health interest, if you can get things to be called vaccines, you are on a winning cash cow. And that's what Anthony Fauci has been doing since 1984. He's tried to get the entire pharmacopoeia that he can get transferred over into a vaccine, which is part of the reason why we have so stinking many vaccines, despite the fact that during the same period of time since 1984, we've seen allergies actually skyrocket. We've seen the general health of the population decrease. All the while, $191 billion since 1984 has flowed directly through his hands to create a vaccine mantra for anything he can touch. Now, the link between forcing the world into a vaccine model and the removal of culpability is actually something that was not anticipated by the 1986 Congressional Act, which is the famous Childhood Vaccination Injury Act. The 1986 Act was really about a very small set of vaccines that were considered to be necessary for public health, usually given to children. They were not intended, and the 86 Act never anticipated either the injuries or the side effects coming from the genetically modified gene therapy interventions and various other forms of interventions that have been passed off as vaccines since 1986. But that hasn't changed the fact that using the momentum of the 1905 Jacobson case and using the momentum of the 1986 Act, every vaccine that has come out has been singularly focused on getting itself under the liability and immunity shield. What makes this a problem beyond the self-evident nature of corporations with no culpability, which is always a problem? What makes this a problem is that public health officials in every state in this country have been essentially appointed to promote the police powers side of this business without ever considering having any independent view of whether or not the police power statutes under which they're authorized are actually relevant. And I'll give you a very specific example. In the 1905 Jacobson case, the Supreme Court majority opinion stated that the reason why vaccines were acceptable was because the public interest, meaning that the community value of making sure a pathogen did not get transmitted through a population, superseded the individual interest. And that's a very important distinction. And Jacobson has made it abundantly clear that the value of a vaccination is not to the individual, but to the community, thus giving rise to the notion of police powers. Here's where the problem comes in. Both the Moderna and Pfizer gene therapies that are currently being injected into humans across this country are actually not vaccines using the legal and statutory definition of what that term means. Because a vaccine by legal definition is a thing that stimulates immunity and makes it so that a person exposed to a pathogen does not get an infection. And if you look at what the clinical trials for the COVID trial, and I won't give them the courtesy of using the term vaccine. If you look at their gene therapy trials, they specifically made reference to the fact that they could not measure the presence or absence of a virus, and they could not measure the presence or absence of infectivity or transmissivity. In other words, all of the things that would make a vaccine are actually not part of the clinical trial for either Moderna or Pfizer. The reason why they're calling this gene chemotherapy a vaccine is to try to sneak it under the tent of the liability shield. Because while the emergency use authorization creates shielded liabilities with respect to the PrEP Act, which is actually something that kind of came out of the domestic and international terrorism fears of the early 2000s, the fact of the matter is, the minute the declaration of emergency ends, if it was not a vaccine, a medical countermeasure under emergency use authorization would not be able to be distributed. But if you call something that's not a vaccine, and then you get people to go along with it, then after the emergency use authorization is lifted, you can actually get state health authorities, you can get employers and travel agencies and border control and all kinds of other people to say, oh, this is a vaccine and you need to take it. But let's get something abundantly clear. Neither Pfizer nor Moderna is manufacturing a vaccine. They are manufacturing, and listen very carefully to what I'm saying because it's their words out of their own securities filings with the SEC and with regulatory agencies. What they are doing is they are doing gene therapy technology, which elucidates specifically the stimulation of a pathogen creation within your cell. They are not stimulating immunity as a primary outcome. What they are doing is getting your body to make the S1 spike protein that coronaviruses have associated with them. They are not making something that has a primary outcome of immune response. The best they can hope for, and by the way, this is hope, but as recently as October and December, when the two phase 3 clinical trials were published, as recently as October and December, both studies made it abundantly clear that no virus has actually been attenuated, no virus has been killed, and no virus has been manipulated in one form or another, and it has not been blocked by any of their interventions. So the fact is self-evidently and could not be clearer. There is no vaccine in the US right now. There's a gene chemotherapy agent being passed off as a vaccine to get immunity shield from liability for the corporation, not to get immunity to coronavirus infection.
Why is it that you know this in the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, all the major agencies have not shared a single statement of what you just said?
The motivation behind all of what has passed off as the COVID-19 domestic terrorism and global terrorism campaign has co-opted the media. The reason why I use the term domestic terrorism is because under Section 802 of the Patriot Act, when you incite fear in a population for the benefit of a cause or ideology, that is the definition of domestic terrorism. When Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York gets in front of a camera and lies to the people of America saying that New York needs 60,000 ventilators and you're going to have to choose which 20,000 people are going to die, which are things that he said, when, by the way, New York never used all the ventilators it had, and ventilators were actually not indicated in the majority of cases where they were being used in the first place. But at no point has any fact checker come along and said that Andrew Cuomo lied. But he did. He is not going to be called out for his lie, just like governors across the country are not going to be called out for their lies for a very simple reason. Their lie is necessary for the treasonous acts that are in fact happening across this country and around the world. The fact is very clear. Under every version of, for example, the Federal Trade Commission Act. Under every definition of 21 Code of Federal Regulations, what is being done to the public right now is illegal action. We are participating in a compulsory clinical trial of untested medical interventions for the benefit of unnamed interests and at the expense of our lives and our livelihoods. This is an illegal act where the individuals responsible for the information dissemination in this country have been either co-opted or are willfully participating in the fraud. Now, the reason why I say either co-opted or willfully participating is that we have made this information available to a number of news outlets. And with the exception of the Financial Times, who, by the way, has not published a negative comment on this information. So I commend them for not being part of the overwhelming message control. They just haven't published the information. With the exception of them, there has been no respectable mainstream media outlet who has even considered to actually deliver this message, because if they did, and by the way, you think about this, New York Times, Washington Post, historically, the ones that bucked the system, the ones that supported deep investigative journalism, they built their brands on that. Not a single one of them has uncovered a shred of what I've just been describing, despite the fact that the public record is abundantly clear on all of these points, which means they are willfully not participating in the inquiry that we all expect the Fourth Estate to be a part of.
Step further, if you would, please, David. They have promoted headlines repeatedly that Moderna and Pfizer are 95% effective or 93.5% effective, giving the impression for the average person that if you took the vaccine, it's going to stop the virus from infecting you or you infecting other people, and therefore you can return to work, return to a normal life because you are now a part of that vaccinated herd group. That is the impression that they have foisted upon the American public. Second to that, every day they have now on their front page, the New York Times and other media have done similarly, they have stated cases of corona by conflating those who test positive with a faulty test. And I know it's faulty because I was the first person to film the Kary Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in 1993 for discovering the PCR. And in that interview, which is now viral on the internet, you will see it's a two-hour interview. That's just 2 minutes of it, where he clearly states, and there is no equivocation, that you cannot use his PCR test to determine viral load or pathogenicity of any virus. So therefore, if we're using a non-gold standard, incomplete, inaccurate test, and then replicating up to 40, 45 times, which means you have no active virus there. And yet the New York Times says if you test positive or otherwise healthy, have no symptoms, and they did 40, 45 different enhancements of that using PCR, you are a case. And in the public's mind, the gestalt of this is that you are sick and you are a person who could infect others or be dying yourself. And so we have these points of continuing to this. And I know that there are very brilliant people with great backgrounds who are intellectually capable of looking for the truth and finding it at all of these media institutions. Yet at this moment, I do not find any of them willing to tell the truth about how Moderna and Pfizer's vaccines are not effective, as they stated, nor are the cases, actual cases of coronavirus, nor have they at all challenged the PCR as being an unreliable test. Those are the three things that are the triumphant of miscommunication, fraudulent science, holding this entire edifice together. Yeah. Could you just share your insights on this, please?
Well, You're exactly right. The issue goes back to the February definition of COVID-19. The ICTV, which was the International Committee for the Taxonomy of Viruses, working together with the World Health Organization, determined that there was going to be this thing called COVID-19. Now, people need to understand COVID-19 is not caused by anything, because COVID-19 is a family of clinical symptoms. It is not a disease. COVID-19 has no disease attribute. It is, in fact, a set of clinical symptoms that may or may not have anything to do with the presence or absence of a virus or a bacteria or a fungus or anything, any host of a number of other things. COVID-19 was, by the World Health Organization's own definition, separate and distinct from SARS-CoV-2. Those are two different things. So every time the COVID dashboard, which is what all the media are using, which, by the way, the COVID dashboard project funded by Michael Bloomberg, Bill Gates, and Zuckerberg through their partnership, that's who owns the COVID dashboard. The ownership of the COVID dashboard in partnership with Johns Hopkins University and in partnership with the Chinese-owned Worldometer, which is the self-referential validating loop that Johns Hopkins uses on its data, which is actually a Chinese-owned company that actually supplies, allegedly, the global monitoring of infection, which I find to be somewhat comically ironic. But the fact of the matter is that institution has willfully lied to the American people because, to your point, it conflates a positive PCR test, which everyone knows is not measuring the coronavirus. It is measuring a fragment of a nucleic acid sequence thought to be associated with this virus, and nor has it ever measured the presence of a virus. But they are saying that a positive PCR test means that you are, in fact, infected with a virus. That statement itself is not true and cannot be true. Further, they are saying that a positive test is, in fact, a case of coronavirus. However, they're not applying the standard equivalently because they're calling a COVID death a death without having to test for the RT-PCR. So if you live and you're healthy, you can allegedly be infected with a positive RT-PCR outcome. But if you die, you don't have to be tested for any causation. You can just be thrown into a bucket of, if you sniffled before you croaked, you're dead and therefore COVID. This is an egregious violation of any scientific or clinical principle. So the fact of the matter is, people who had a financial vested interest in creating a global campaign of terror so that they could get a vaccine agenda advanced have decided that at all costs, there will be no truth told. None. And anyone who does tell independently verifiable truth will be marginalized or silenced because the truth will not be out. And so we have a situation where every single statement I have made, every statement I have made is verified by source documentation I maintain. And this is source documentation, not that I maintain in some sort of very secret, you know, hacked, cracked database. This is information that I've been collecting since I started monitoring the coronavirus pathogen in 1999. So the fact of the matter is, I don't open my mouth about a thing unless I have the document that verifies every single statement that I have made. The fact is that we are living in a campaign of terror. This is an act of destruction of our economy and of the global economy. And it is being done by individuals who know they are lying. This is not a close call. This is not a best efforts. There is not a chance that the journalists who are sitting on their pens or their typewriters or their keyboards, they are not participating in some sort of lack of effort kind of thing. They are actively involved in a campaign of right now information and economic warfare against the citizens of this country. And they are participating in it and contributing to the death and destruction of this country.
One final thought on this. You mentioned Bill Gates. You mentioned Zuckerberg, and also one of the other top people in the field, Bloomberg. Look at Bill Gates. If there's one person beyond all who is not a scientist, he is not a medical doctor, he's not a nutritionist, he's not an immunologist, and yet through his foundation, he is the most important voice, the most powerful voice, and the most consistent voice saying that everyone on the planet should be vaccinated. And only when everyone is vaccinated, then can we start to return to normal. But until that time, it shouldn't happen. But then now they're talking about, along with Klaus Schwab, the top person at the World Economic Forum, that this also represents an opportunity for a great reset.
Right.
Should we be concerned that in any way what has happened with COVID will allow these very powerful people, very wealthy people, these major policymakers, to then be able to take even further advantage, if that indeed is their motive, of a helpless, misinformed public about the future?
Let's tackle three things. First of all, the COVID tracking project, for people who don't know, is the official data reporting for the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, Vox, ProPublica, the Wall Street Journal, Politico, and NPR. In other words, all the spectrums of the media distribution is using the exact same platform, and that platform is licensed by The Atlantic, the publication you know, The Atlantic, and the foundation, the COVID Tracking Project Foundation, is supported by the Zuckerberg, the Bloomberg, and the Gates Foundation. So the people who are running this entire campaign of terror are the three organizations I just described, passed through The Atlantic. If you look at what's happened, there is I've said this is an act of war, and people say, well, what's the nation state actor that's involved? You know, is this China attacking the U.S.? I have made the comment, and this is now Dave Martin going out on a limb. This is not Dave Martin, the fact conveyor. This is Dave Martin positing a hypothesis. I believe that Michael Bloomberg, that Zuckerberg, and that Gates have actually declared war on the Westphalian nation state model. I think what this is not about a country harming another country. I think this is actually the evidence of the corporatocracy finally exerting itself over the nation state actor. And if you look at the language that's been involved in the World Economic Forum with Klaus Schwab, if you look at the language that's been used around the, quote, Great Reset, if you look at all of these things, what you find is that state-level actors have been deemed irrelevant, and corporate actors, for their own best interest, whether their best interest be commercial or whether their best interest be ideological, in the case of somebody like the Gates Foundation, the fact of the matter is the war is not against state actors. This is the corporations and foundations finally telling the state actors they are no longer relevant. What we have is not a coup of leadership in the classic democratic sense. What we have is a coup of the entirety of the Westphalian nation state model. And we now have the hegemony of independent foundations who are now going to dictate the future.
You said that you had to be out at this particular time. We're at the end of our program. We're honoring your wish. I'm hopeful that you will make time to come back and rejoin us at a future date, and we will see how prophetic you are, how accurate you are, and we'll also, by at least another 2 months from now, 3 months from now, after the next Davos meeting and the meeting of the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab, will see more of their agenda.
That's
thank
exactly.
you very much. And
Gary,
thank you for having the courage. All the best to you, Dr. or Professor David Martin. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.